In the wake of the discovery of two bodies believed to be the missing Evansdale cousins, new worries, new questions are arising about how to keep children safe. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Nancy McBride of the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. She'll tell us how to keep children safe and how to talk to your child about potential danger. Then, we delve into bystander psychology. We'll talk with Iowa State University psychology professor Craig Anderson about why we might or might not intervene to prevent a tragedy. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Autopsies of the bodies believed to be the two missing Evansdale girls were completed Friday, but investigators remained hushed about what medical examiners found or how that could help police identify suspects. It was last Wednesday that hunters discovered the bodies in a wooded area along the Wapsipinicon River, about 25 miles north of Evansdale, and authorities expressed confidence that they were the bodies of the cousins, Lyric Cook Morrissey and Elizabeth Collins. The girls disappeared in July. In the wake of this tragedy, we want to talk about something that is surely on the minds of parents, especially child safety. And joining us this half hour, Nancy McBride. She is the National Safety Director for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. And I'd just like to express my condolences to the community and your listeners for the remains of Lyric Cook and Elizabeth being found. I'm very sorry with that outcome.
Thank you for those words. We're all still in shock here across Iowa. And we know you have a lot of information, statistics about safety. But first of all, can you say from information what sort of person is likely to abduct your child?
Well, there's not actually a profile of these abductors, unfortunately. They kind of run the gamut across the board. And what we know about these offenders and abductors is they look for access and opportunity. And the unfortunate part is we can't tell them by looking at them. And I always say if adults can't tell who the good guys and the bad guys are, neither can kids. So I think the one message here is to be very alert to the people, the adults who have contact with your kids, because they can be very tenacious, they can be very patient, and they can be very engaging.
Mm-hmm. And this is along those lines. This is also why on your website, your center does not advise to talk to your son exclusively about stranger danger, this phrase. Why is that?
Well, and this is a phrase that I'd like to have retired when I retire, but I don't think I'm going to be successful. Unfortunately, stranger danger is not a very effective message for kids because we know that the danger to children is far greater from somebody they or you know than from that faceless, nameless person. We also know kids don't get it. If you ask them who a stranger is, they're going to describe somebody who's mean or ugly or dirty or big or, you know, all kinds of adjectives that don't necessarily describe anybody. And we also don't, as adults, practice it in our regular lives. So when you're telling kids never talk to strangers and you're engaging in conversation with people you don't know, that's a very, very confusing concept to a child.
Mm. Since most abductions are committed by a person a child knows, how then should we talk to our sons, our daughters about this concept of personal safety?
Well, I think it's really important, Ben, that we talk to our kids about anybody who makes them feel scared, uncomfortable, or confused. And part of that messaging to children is that their safety is more important than being polite. So if the child feels that they're in danger or they're somehow confused or scared, their job as a child is to get out of the situation and tell a trusted adult what happened. We don't want kids engaging in a lot of conversation with people, particularly those they don't know, obviously. But we know, as I said before, that these offenders can be very disarming to children. So once that conversation starts, it puts the child in a vulnerable place.
Mm-hmm. And that's a potential because, I mean, especially here in the Midwest, we we are polite, and we teach our children to be polite, even
right.
to strangers who may talk to them in the supermarket or something like mm-hmm. that. So mm-hmm. how do you walk that line?
Well, I think the way you walk the line is when you're with the child, particularly a young child, and you're talking to somebody you don't know, that's the difference. You're with them. But when you're not with them, then these rules apply that they really should not be engaging in a conversation, and they should keep their distance. That's probably the most important thing I can say today, is to make sure that kids don't get too close to these people, and obviously never, ever approach or get into a vehicle with an individual.
Mm-hmm. What ages are we talking about? Is there a profile, a graph that would show us the ages most at danger?
Well, you're going to be surprised by this. Contrary to what the public may think, that 11 to 17-year-old child is equally at risk to the abduction and harm to the very younger child. So that makes sense on a level of we know these kids are given more freedoms, they're making more decisions, they're out there. So I think when you're looking at younger kids, hopefully those are the kids who are being supervised, whereas that older age child is really looking for that freedom. And as a parent or guardian, you want to give it to them a little bit at a time, knowing that they're also at risk.
Mm-hmm. We have very recently talked about the scourge of human trafficking. So I suppose that comes into the picture also when people would be surprised at 15, 16, 17-year-olds being at risk.
Right, absolutely. And we know that a lot of the runaways who leave their homes leave for a reason. There's something going on in the house that they don't feel they can deal with. And when they run away, they're put in an obviously vulnerable situation. They have to try to get by. They have to have money for food. They have to have a place to live. And that oftentimes will lead them into the arms, literally, of somebody with these bad intentions.
Let's talk about some of the other statistics that you bring out at your website, at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, that in attempted abduction incidents analyzed by your center, a good deal of them, 72% of them, involve the suspect driving a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why that is a good tool for an abductor.
Ooh, because the intention of the abductor is to get that child out of that immediate area as quickly as possible. And I always tell parents when I speak that once you're in the vehicle, everything changes. I mean, the odds are so far against that child being able to get away, which is why we want to make sure none of these kids fall for whatever these tricks are that the abductor may be using. And it's so strange to me, but they're the same old tricks. You know, it's candy, money. Animals, can I give you a ride? I mean, this is the way the person tries to engage in conversation to get the child close to the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. So these tricks, even though we've had literally decades of talking about don't take candy from strangers and
mm-hmm.
so forth,
yes.
they are still the tricks that work.
They're still the tricks that work, and it was interesting. I had a member of our content team who does some of our child safety material ask me for new tricks, and I said, before we get new tricks, why don't we find out how the old tricks are doing? And that was part of the data that was collected in the attempted abduction analysis. Offering the child a ride happened in 32% of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, just, hey, do you want to get in my car and go for a ride? You want me to take you somewhere? So, and then the candy was number two on the list with 12%. So some kids are still susceptible to those kind of tricks. And you have to look behind the trick. It's the kindness, allegedly, of the person making the offer. I mean, kids can be disarmed by an adult being nice to them and offering them something that they want.
Mm-hmm. Now, abductors, you said they look for signs of vulnerability, weakness in mm-hmm. people off their guard. Are they then perhaps in a town, in some area, more or less casing it as a thief would case a house or a bank or something?
I think we have some offenders who do that, but we also have the ones, again, who I said look for access and opportunity. So if they're, and as you saw from the study, 35% of the attempts happen when a child was going to and from school or a school-related activity. That's where these offenders are going to go. They're going to go where there are children. And what better place than kids walking to and from school? obviously they're going to look for a child who may be walking alone, who may not be paying that much attention, and that would be the child who would be most vulnerable. It's definitely safer for kids to be in groups, but that also is not the panacea. I mean, we need to make sure that younger children are properly supervised by older siblings or trusted adults or somebody in that family or that community who's watching out for them.
So on the way to and from school, 35% of attempted abductions occur on this path, on this transit. What are the safety tips there?
Well, I've seen it happen time and time again, Ben. When there is a situation, a tragic event in a community, everybody draws together, and you see a lot of parents walking their kids to and from school or walking with them while they ride their bike or waiting with them at the bus stop. And then, unfortunately, as time goes by, we kind of let our guard down again, and we're not necessarily that vigilant. And I guess my message here today is safety is 365 days a year. So being that involved parent or trusted adult could make all the difference here.
If you've just joined our conversation, is this half hour with Nancy McBride, National Safety Director for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, talking about child safety in the wake of the tragedy involving the Evansdale girls. I wonder, sex offender registries are new in many states, including Iowa, fairly new anyway. Have they been a help?
They're a terrific tool, Ben. I always say when we look at the resources we have available to us now versus even 10 years ago, the sex offender registry would be top of my list, and it serves a dual function. One, you can find out who the registered sex offenders are and where they are in the proximity of your neighborhood. And number two, you can check people who have contact with your children against the sex offender registry, because oftentimes some of these offenders may slip through the cracks and may not be caught in that process they go through to sign up for a sporting coach or to be, you know, some sort of after school program person. So again, this is an opportunity for parents and guardians to do their due diligence for obviously the program or the accreditation agency for them to do their due diligence and make sure this person has not committed a sex offense even in another state.
Nancy, let's go back to something you said a little earlier. You said once a child is abducted, the whole picture changes. And you've had some studies at this point, attempted abduction cases where the child didn't know his or her abductor and somehow got away. How often do kids get away, and how do they manage it?
Well, I call this the good news study, because in 81% of these over 7,000 cases we've looked at, the child has gotten away. 53% got away because they just walked or ran away. They didn't have any contact with a person. And in 28% of the cases, they engaged in some sort of reaction, either yelling, kicking, pulling away, attracting attention. In other words, doing everything they could to resist the offender. And in the last 19%, a good Samaritan or a parent was able to step in and help the kids. So we know kids are getting the message if they are taught and if they practice the skills on a regular basis with a parent or guardian or a teacher in their life or whoever that person is. They can have the skills to escape these abductors.
How do you go about teaching a child to do that, a 7 or 8 year old to do that?
Well, you do it from a very positive point of view. Everything that we have at the National Center as far as our materials is very, very positive. You don't ever want to use fear, because fear is not a motivator. Fear paralyzes people. And I always say to adults out there, kids live in the real world. They know it's a scary place already, so we don't need to reinforce that. That's already out there. So what you're doing with your child is you're empowering your child with the self-confidence, with the knowledge, with the skill set, so if they ever encounter a situation like this, they know what to do. And remember what I said at the very beginning, the only job of the child is to get out of the situation as quickly as possible and tell a trusted adult. That should be the ongoing message that is reinforced with anybody who's teaching a child about child safety.
Mm-hmm. So this has really changed from when I was a kid. Fear was really the factor that was impressed upon us. And studies have shown that does not work.
It doesn't work because it's really a paralyzer. And if you think about, at least when I grew up, we did not have all the technology and all the media we have today. So you've got to figure this child is being exposed to the crimes that are committed on a fairly regular basis. So knowing that the child is already informed on that level, you don't want to really reinforce that anymore, because then a lot of times kids will shut down because they're going to feel powerless to really do anything about the situation. So when you sit down and you have the conversation with your child, you do it in a very reassuring way. Hey, we're going to talk about safety today. We're going to talk about some skills that, or some tips or whatever you want to call them, that I'm going to teach you so that if anything ever happens, you'll know what to do. And when you reinforce these skills and you practice these skills just like you do with any other habit you're trying to teach a child, then it becomes part of that child's regular day-to-day activity. So they won't be put off or they won't be disarmed should they ever encounter somebody like this.
Mm-hmm. And the relationship is very important there, because you want to have your child be able to talk about feelings of being uncomfortable with someone perhaps that you know in your community.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's the parent or guardian, it's the teacher, it's a trusted adult in that child's life. And we want to make sure kids know, you talk to an adult until somebody believes you. If you've got a situation and people aren't listening to you, then you go tell somebody else until you get somebody to pay attention and help you with whatever that situation is.
If a child becomes lost, what should you advise him or her to do?
Well, the first thing I say is stay very close to where you got lost, because this is where people are going to start looking for you. If you get separated from your parent, let's say at a mall, then you don't want to go far away from where you've lost contact, because you know the parent or guardian's coming back. And the last thing you ever want to do is leave the mall and go to the parking lot. So stay close. And then look for somebody. We refer to them as low-risk helping adults, whether it's a store clerk with a name tag or a uniformed police officer. That person's always somebody that you can go to for help, or somebody in an information booth, and just let them know what's going on and they will assist you. So don't be afraid to ask for help, which is the last reason stranger danger is so bad, because if you've taught your kids never, ever, ever talk to strangers, who are they going to seek out if they need help if they're separated from you?
Mm-hmm. One of the other points that you bring up that may be a surprise is that your center stresses don't rely on your child's judgment. If the child, and we hear this from preteens, from teens, I know what I'm doing, you don't have to do this. You know, you know this tone of voice that you get from children of all ages, is that they want to be old, they want to be grown up, they want to make their own judgment calls, but you say that's not always, and that's not a good tactic.
Well, and it usually isn't a good tactic if you don't feel as a parent or guardian that your child has the skills or the judgment to make that call. And I always tell parents, regardless of technology, regardless of what your child can do, you have an advantage because you've got the experience and you've got the judgment. So we shouldn't forget that as adults, that we still have that to impart to our kids, even if they're resistant to listen. So try to, you know, fight through those barriers, but do it in a way that you're having a dialogue rather than a lecture. I mean, if you can engage your child in that conversation, have them talk to you about why they feel that they can handle themselves, and then give them some what-if scenarios and see how they would respond to those. What if, for example, somebody offered you tickets to a concert you really wanted to go to? What would you do if you didn't know that person? And it's kind of interesting to me when we look at some of the undercover news segments we've done with older kids, they seem to be as susceptible to these different tricks as some of the younger kids. If it's something they want, if it's an opportunity to be in a television show, or it's some kind of item that they want, they will let their guard down if the person seems to be nice, and they will go with this person to get whatever it is they want. So just because a child is older doesn't mean they're necessarily using that good judgment.
Nancy, a couple of things I wanted to get in here quickly before we have to say goodbye today. We all need to rely on people to supervise our children in many different capacities. What can you say about selecting, whether it be babysitters, Sunday school teachers, coaches? What can you say about them?
I say go back and do your due diligence and find out everything you can about that person. You can do it by talking to other people. You can check the sex offender registry. You can get references from them that are, you know, different than some friend that they've known for 10 years. I mean, really, really do your due diligence on that person. And the best thing you can do is observe them with your child and do that on a regular basis. Because if you are an involved, caring parent or guardian, whoever that is going to see that, and you'll be able to discern how that person acts with your child. And the only other thing I'd say is be very, very careful if this person is making promises to you like, I can make your child a sports star, or your child has all this raw talent, I want to work with him one-on-one. Be very, very cautious about that, because if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
What should you do if your child does go missing? The first steps you should take?
Well, the first thing you do is you do a CURS research, and I mean very quickly. And if you are not able to find your child, do not hesitate to call law enforcement, because we know time is the enemy if a child is abducted. So right away, call law enforcement. I tell parents and guardians, with all the digital technology we have today, if you're going out and about to a mall, say, for example, or an amusement park, take a photo of your child on your phone and just keep it, because that's going to be the best rendition of what your child looked like at that point in time. And if you do find that you are separated from your child, give authorities that photo, because getting that good photo out there is probably the single most important tool in getting a child located and recovered.
Nancy, the reason we're having this conversation is the great tragedy involving the two girls from Evansdale. What can Iowans take from this disappearance, the apparent death of Elizabeth Collins and Lyric Cook, that is at least something good?
Well, I think the good thing is that the legacy of these two young girls will be your community really drawing together, really addressing the whole issue of child safety as a community, because it really takes everybody. It takes the parent or guardian, it takes the teacher, it takes law enforcement, it takes that bystander who might be in a situation where they see something is happening to a child and they're not sure what to do. So my message there for the bystanders is step up, get involved, call law enforcement. Law enforcement wants these calls. And as a community, if you see anything or anyone who seems inappropriate, contact law enforcement about that person. We know that these offenders are very mobile and they're very transient. So again, law enforcement wants those kind of calls.
And being the polite people we are in the Midwest, bystanders often don't do something because they say, well, what if I'm wrong? That would get somebody in a lot of trouble. But you say, if you have a suspicion, you need to get in touch with authorities.
Right, because even if you're wrong, there's really not much of a harm there. And if you're right, you could be saving a child's life.
Nancy McBride, tell us where we can find your center on the web so that people can follow up on some of the things we've talked about.
At missingkids.com, and all of our publications are free to download. And also 1-800-THE-LOST is our 24-hour hotline. You will get a live person.
Okay, thank you very much. Nancy McBride, National Safety Director for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Thank you for your time, Nancy, and your tips here.
Thank you, Ben.
So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week in New York City, a 58-year-old man died when he was hit by a subway train. Evidently, a homeless man pushed him onto the tracks during a physical confrontation. His death has garnered a lot of media attention, both because of the grisly nature of his death, but also because of a photograph. Maybe you've seen it. It was taken moments before the man died. The photographer R. Umar Abbasi has been accused of being exploitative. Abbasi says that he did so in a desperate attempt, to alert the driver of the train to stop by using the flash of his camera. Many have asked, why didn't anyone on the platform help this man down on the tracks during this emergency situation? It may have been something known as the bystander effect. Joining us to explain this and related psychology, Craig Anderson, Iowa State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology. He researches the social judgment process and joins us from our studio in Ames. Craig Anderson, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be here.
I understand it goes by other names as well. People may know it by the bystander effect or the Genovese syndrome, also bystander apathy. What is it?
Well, basically, it turns out that there are a number of things that have to happen in order for a bystander to intervene. Some of these events or some of these decisions are fairly obvious, but others are less obvious. So, for example, the first thing that has to happen is a person has to notice that they have to notice the event. They have to notice a situation that might be dangerous. And while that may seem obvious that, if you're sort of standing there in the general, facing the general direction of some event, that you would notice it. But in fact, if people's minds are occupied on something else, they tend to miss all sorts of things. So, if you're walking down the street talking on your cell phone and a clown rides by on a unicycle right in front of you, right, a fair amount of the time people won't even notice it. They'll get a half a block later and then someone will stop them and ask, did you see the clown on the unicycle? And they'll say, what?
And this has been proven.
Yeah. So if you're in a hurry, if you're distracted by other people, if you're deep in thought about something, you might not even notice an event happening, an event that could require your assistance. So that's really the first step. And my guess is, without having any great details on what happened in this particular event, but my guess is some of the people didn't really notice anything going on until it was much too late.
We can imagine, we don't know exactly how many people were on this platform, but people are busy in their daily routines. They have their smartphones. They're chatting with each other. So
right.
a certain number of them will say, we're not aware. Okay, go
right.
on.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in fact, the more people that are around, this is one of the ironies about the in the bystander intervention kind of effect, is that when the more people that are around, the less likely you are to actually notice other things going on, in part because just having people around is itself distracting. So the second step is then, assuming that you actually see the event, is you have to interpret it as an emergency. Now, in this particular case, I would think that almost anybody who would who saw it would have interpreted it as an emergency, but in many circumstances in life where emergencies sort of arise in a more subtle way, what people tend to do if they're not sure it's an emergency is they start looking at other people to see how are other people reacting.
Mm.
But everyone's trying to act cool, right? You don't want to be sort of display a public image of yourself as some wildly, kind of crazy person. So if you look around to see how other people are acting while you're acting cool, everyone else is doing the same thing. That tends to lead to everyone to decide, oh, this isn't really an emergency. So again, it's one of those cases where having more people around can actually lead to less likelihood of anyone stepping up to help.
And after that, then what has to happen if they do perceive it as an emergency?
Right. The third step then is the potential bystander has to take responsibility for providing help. And there are a lot of things that can reduce that feeling of personal responsibility. If there are a lot of other people around, what you tend to get is what's called diffusion of responsibility. That is, people tend to think, well, someone else is probably more capable or more responsible to help than I am. So it's not, you know, it's not really my job. It's not my responsibility. Assuming, again, in this case, you know, people might feel somewhat responsible once they've identified it. And again, this is a case where, at least according to one news report, there was only like 22 seconds or so for people to respond. So there's not a lot of time for thought here. But even, you know, if you get to the point where some bystanders decide, oh, gosh, I should do something. It is at least partially my responsibility. Then they have to decide whether they can help or how to help. So you can imagine any number of people for physical reasons would realize quite quickly there's nothing that they can do.
Well, right? Yeah, in this case, the man is, what, 6 feet down in on the tracks, which
right.
is a good 6 feet or more below the platform.
Yep.
And so you have to be able to lift someone in a certain time frame because this train is coming, right?
Exactly. So, you know, if you're an 85-year-old woman weighing 85 pounds or something, you know, you're not going to, you know, you would know almost immediately, this is not something I can physically do.
Yep. So all those five things being fulfilled, then you might intervene.
Then you might intervene. And of course, even the, you know, an 85-year-old, very lightweight person could intervene in a different way. Again, there's not much time here, but they could, for example, quickly find someone who's big and say, look, this guy needs help. You come help. Mm-hmm. And kind of pull them over. But again, there's not a lot of time in this particular case. So,
Craig Anderson is with us, Iowa State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology. We're talking about the so-called bystander effect. Perhaps you, river-to-river listeners, you've been helping out. You've considered, you have helped out in an emergency situation. What made you decide to help? Have you ever had an emergency while in a group of people? What happened? Does this sound familiar? These steps, does that click in with an experience that you've had? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I looked at another piece of news from a couple of years ago. In studying this, I'm sure you looked at this one, too, which we all became aware of, the tragedy of the mass shooting in Tucson, Arizona in January of 2011, took the lives of several and severely injured U.S. Representative Gabriella Giffords. The remarkable courage of the bystanders was shown in the reports there to stop
right.
the shooter. It was a 74-year-old retired Army Colonel Bill Badgers, whose head was grazed by a bullet during the shooting, that somehow this 74-year-old Army colonel, retired Army colonel, wrestled the shooter, 22-year-old Jared Loeffner, to the ground as he continued to fire. Another reaction here worth noting, Daniel Hernandez, he was the intern who worked for Representative Gabrielle Giffords for just a week, ran toward the gunfire. He held Giffords in his arms, possibly saving her life, I think applying pressure to a wound. Comments on this case?
Yes, and I don't want to give the impression that people never help because, of course, we all know a lot of people do intervene. People are more likely to intervene if they feel they have some expertise in the area, people who view themselves as the kind of people who help out. So police, firefighters, medical people.
Army colonel.
Army colonel.
Would have
exactly.
remembered his training.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. You know, Army colonel, I don't care if he's 85 or whatever, you know, it's probably not someone you want to mess with.
Right.
If he stayed in shape and so on. So, yeah, there are certainly a lot of heroes out there. In fact, there was a case not too long ago in New York City of someone falling onto a platform and some stranger jumping down, tossing them back up over the top, and then climbing out himself. So people do help. But one of the things that increases the likelihood of people coming to the aid of others is if they know something or have heard about this whole bystander effect. That if so, for example, people who take social psychology classes like the one I teach, and we cover the bystander intervention effect, there's actually been studies showing that simply having such a class and being made aware of how bizarre variables like having other people around can actually reduce helping. Simply knowing about that increases the likelihood that that person will identify a situation as an emergency and will take some kind of action.
Okay, let's go to our callers. We have a few phone calls. Brad in Bettendorf. Brad, do you have an experience that you're reminded of by this conversation?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Now, I have two examples, and the first is one of a woman choking to death and a dozen people standing around doing nothing, just sort of frozen. And I'm just curious if I expected to hear your guest talk about this freeze effect or everybody just sort of freeze.
Brad, was this something you personally experienced in a restaurant, perhaps?
It was at the office. The second example, similar, is a woman going into a grand mal seizure, and as I'm clearing her throat of vomit, yelling, "Somebody dial 911!" The three guys at the counter took off running out the door.
Not doing anything, just getting out.
Oh, just really fearful of the circumstance, and just freaking out. I got to get out of here, thinking. So those are the two examples that I can cite, and I'm not sure what you would do about it other than I think everybody ought to be prepared to be able to step in and save a life and just be aware that that moment might come at any time.
Very stark examples.
Right.
Brad, thank you for that. Let's get a comment from Craig Anderson.
Right. Oh, no, he's exactly right that in some circumstances people will be frozen with fear, or at least some people will, and that has to somehow be overcome. One of the things that, of course, is much more easily done now than you know, even 15, 20 years ago is using the cell phone, calling, 911. If you find that you're in a situation either that requires your help or that requires someone else's help, one way to get other people to help, one way to overcome this diffusion of responsibility is to make eye contact with someone, look at them, point at them and say, "You call 911 or you come here," because that helps identify the situation as one that requires help. And it tends to get rid of this diffusion of responsibility.
Let's go to Rebecca in Des Moines. What did you experience, Rebecca?
Hi, yes. I lived in Boston a few years ago, and I witnessed a man getting mugged. And I saw people literally walking by and even crossing the street to get away from the situation. And I remember feeling like the pit of my stomach, like how much sadness I was having with humanity as a whole. And before even thinking, like I'm a young, pretty small girl, I screamed and ran over and stayed with the man and called 911. And afterwards, I just kind of was thinking about the situation and how, people couldn't even get their phones out and call 911. They just kind of walked away.
Wow. Craig Anderson, what about that one?
Well, again, possibly what was going on was some of the people didn't recognize what was, that it really was an emergency situation. In part because other people were walking away as well. There are other little things like fear of personal harm and whatnot might well intervene. Although, again, it's as the caller mentioned, it's kind of hard to imagine why someone wouldn't call 911.
Rebecca, I'm wondering, did you have a thought process that you thought about afterwards that you went through? Or was it a real just reaction where you would say, "I could have only done what I did to intervene"?
Yeah, there was really no thought process. I just immediately was like, "Oh my gosh, this person is in danger." And I just thought that if I made myself seem really big, the mugger would run away. I didn't think about danger to myself. And probably in retrospect, if I had more time to think, I would say, "Ooh, maybe I shouldn't go over there."
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that way.
Well, congratulations, Rebecca, for intervening and being a hero in this circumstance. And thank you for sharing your story. So what makes Rebecca different from the three men who run out the door while someone's having a seizure?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the situation itself, where people are positioned, what they see, But it also has somewhat to do with one's own experience with helping, or possibly even experience with being a victim in the past. That can make a difference. But as Rebecca was saying, you know, a lot of these, you know, what I've been talking about is kind of decision processes. A lot of these happen so fast that these are not necessarily rational, you know, like you're standing around saying, gee, I wonder what's going on over there, kind of, you know. I mean, these are thought processes that take place so fast that they're not even conscious in many cases.
Mm-hmm. An email from Jamie, wow, this is an experience. My experience with this occurred, writes Jamie, when my daughter fell into a small pool at a hotel that was filled with people. The pool was filled with people. Since it was full, people were in my way to reach her. At first, they didn't notice she was drowning until I started screaming at the person standing right next to rescue her, which she did after several seconds of inaction. So there, she did fulfill a couple of the steps. She made sure the person was aware of the emergency,
right,
and then called to their responsibility, right?
Exactly, yeah. And you can do that if you're the injured person yourself. So if you fall down and you know, break a leg, or you know, severely injured in some way, and people are just kind of walking by, well, the first thing you can do is you can, you know, make it known that this is an emergency. You know, you can actually call out for help. And again, if you can identify someone, make eye contact or point at them, or even describe them, you in that red hat or whatever,
right,
come here.
Right.
All of those things will increase the likelihood of getting the assistance that you need.
Jan is with us from Iowa City. Jan, what's the story you have for us?
Well, my story is it happened a couple of years ago at a county fair in the summer, and there's a group of people, and I kind of walked. I could see something was happening, and I made my way through, and there, two big, you know, guys, probably young guys, were fighting, and I'm just thinking, why is this a spectator sport? And I started my natural, I just ran in and broke up this fight. You know, sort of later I thought, well, I could have been hurt, but you know, it was sort of that whole spectator sport idea of, you know, watching aggression.
Right.
I didn't like the violence.
Right, and a lot of people do make these decisions without thinking for their personal safety, as you recognize, I think you did there, Jan. So what advice do you have, Craig Anderson, when they encounter emergency situations? You certainly have to have this balance. You want to avoid another person possibly being harmed.
Right.
But you also have to balance it with your own personal safety.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, situations that unfold quickly make it very difficult to know what the right decision is for that context. If it's a situation that's taking a little bit longer time, you know, unlike the train situation, you know, you might be able to have a few more thoughts about ways of interrupting the situation. But even like in the case of a couple of people fighting, if one just sort of steps out from the crowd and screams or says, you know, I'm calling the police, if you make enough noise and enough racket, that might, in fact, distract the combatants themselves long enough for them to sort of, oh, maybe this isn't the place to be having this fight.
Right.
But again, all of this stuff is easier to do in hindsight, right? It's all easier to think about in hindsight. But again, if people have thought about what kind of person they would like to be in terms of being a caring, helpful kind of person, and if you sort of make yourself aware that in some emergency situations, everyone else is going to not even see it as an emergency, so you need to be responsible. That should help in general.
Ed, very quickly, we don't have much time left. Do you have an experience to relay?
No, it's just a comment. I think the only chance that guy had was to lie down right in the corner of that on that subway thing, because they're
right.
Yeah, because I mean, if there's no way to pull him up, the only thing you could do is lie down. And,
That would have been, you know, yeah. And
if somebody had the presence of mind to tell him that, then that could be the 85-year-old woman too. You see, so.
Exactly. So there would have been some information that might have saved her life. We don't know. We weren't there. Thank you, Ed, from Mount Pleasant. I wonder if this also has to do something with a big city. I had an example, not necessarily to do with life or death. Well, maybe. I was in a large train station in a big city in Germany. A man had fallen down, and I came upon him just seconds after he had fallen down about 20 steps He was seriously injured, unconscious, bleeding from the head. Emergency responders had arrived, but at the foot of this stairs was a sausage stand, and I was amazed to see people coming and going, getting sausages, some even calmly standing around this injured man, watching and eating. I wondered if this, some of the psychology is going on there is perhaps just the anonymity of a big city and a busy place.
Well, you know, the original case, the Kitty Genovese case in New York City decades ago, in which a young woman was repeatedly stabbed over like a 40-minute period while neighbors didn't call police, sort of led to a lot of people speculating, is this sort of a characteristic of big cities? And it, to some extent, it is, only in that there are more people there.
Right. you have more responsibility that can be diffused and many more people to do it with.
That's right. You're more likely to have a crowd, and that leads to more likelihood of diffusion of responsibility. But there's really not a big difference between, at least in the data that we see, between helpfulness of people, from big cities versus rural areas. As I love rural areas.
Craig Anderson, we have to go. Thank you very much. Fascinating discussion with Iowa State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, who researches social judgment processes. Craig Anderson, thank you for coming into our studio.
You're very welcome, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. And in Ames, we had help from, I believe, Jason Burns today. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.